Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, another interesting and hopefully very enlightening show, dealing with the energies of life. Now, you might say, oh, okay, what's that about? Well, if you think about it, energy is all around us, but life energy is very special, and I'm going to talk about that tonight. And it's kind of an esoteric subject, meaning that, as is typical on this show, it deals with metaphysics and spirituality, as well as some elements of science, all kind of wrapped together. And if we're going to get into there being a difference in energy when it has something to do with life than when it doesn't, that really kind of is the most probably crucial element to what is unknown about life. I mean, besides the fact that life goes on beyond the physical realm, etc., this is kind of like a big subject for at least I think a lot of people, because a lot of people say, well, what's the difference between something that's alive and not alive? I mean, it could be energy in a robot or a computer, and there can be energy inside a dog, a cat, a human being, and the energies are not the same, which would be refuted by some people presently in, we'll say, purely scientific circles. So this is going to be an interesting show, maybe a little controversial for those people who are not so metaphysically inclined. Of course, most of those people aren't listening, really. Maybe they are. I never know. It'd be kind of interesting to find out how many percentage-wise people are in that headspace. Okay, so let me begin, as I usually do, by defining and explaining, et cetera, so that we can have like a good conceptual foundation. The energies that control and define what we call life really come from the same energy that all other energies exist from, which is a place called the spiritual part of our universe. It's called the spiritual dimension. Now, you might say, what is that? What is a spiritual dimension? Well, think of it this way. In the beginning, inception of the universe, spirit and energy are actually joined together. They're not separated. Spirit is the thought of God, and that comes from the first two parts of God's mind. And energy is intelligent interactions of thought of God. And those intelligent interactions are where all energy comes from, but it only manifests itself as energy instead of intelligent interactions when it is less than perfectly efficient in the way that it communicates from one part of energy to another part of energy, the spirit part of God. So if it communicates God's thought perfectly, and it expresses God's thought perfectly, and it senses God's thought perfectly, we could claim that that would not be energy anymore. That would be intelligent activity rejoining with spirit, by the way, and becoming, going back to the state of God's mind, right? But when God's mind separates to create a universe like the one we have, then you have separated energies. You have spirit. And the spirit is, again, the thought of God, sometimes no longer indirectly in God's direction or face. Some people might like that word better. And if it's not in God's direction, then it could be thought that's, who knows, it could be any kind of thought. That isn't necessarily God's thought. That's a kind of interesting idea, isn't it? It doesn't take a whole heck of a lot of things, a very small number, actually, to create an entire universe. I think that's the coolest idea about what I understand about the way the universe was created, was from such simple and direct issues. So I really find that to be fascinating. And at any rate, I would hope that this very brief explanation leads some of our listeners who have not maybe read up on this subject, they may want to check it out, either in what I've written, a textbook, Life's Hidden Meaning, or there's many other books that kind of explain it more mystically, maybe, but fairly similar explanations. Okay, so that's how things start off. in the spiritual plane, the spiritual dimension, spirit separates from intelligent activity, and you have manifested energy. So there's spirit and there's energy. Okay. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that because that's the way God expects it to be. And ultimately, the energy becomes forms for life to grow in and have senses. And the spirit becomes, again, thought, which the life can use to think in ways that are similar to God or in ways that are dissimilar. It chooses that. It has the freedom to choose how it's going to think and also how it's going to interact. If it interacts using its senses made out of energy and its bodies, made out of energy as well, then if it senses in ways that are inaccurate, sometimes called illusions, the results can be very unintelligent activities that causes a waste of time and separates time from space. Now, I won't go into that very deeply, but for those of you who are interested in physics, this leads to all kinds of interesting questions and answers about modern physics. But at any rate, so we have this fascinating, we'll say, beginning. And, I mean, that's great. Then how come energy that starts off being ubiquitous, in other words, it's everywhere because God's mind is everywhere, becomes specialized? Why does some of it develop into life? And let me start off by saying this about that life energy. This week, a couple people have approached me in discussion about the question of life energy. And they wanted to know more about it. They understood some of the vernacular in some cases. And so the interesting thing about this is that life energy is a fascinating subject, but it is not well understood. The words to describe it are known by a vast number of people, but they don't understand the concept behind the words very well because as well known as the words are, the understanding is extremely esoteric at the present time, meaning it's hidden. And very few people really understand what life energy is and how it works, et cetera, except that they're listening to tonight's show. Hopefully, by the end of tonight, we'll have a better understanding about it. I hope so, if I can convey it in a way that makes some sense. All right, so ultimately, on the spiritual plane of Earth, some of the energy becomes, we'll say, a little more resistant to acting on its own. It wants to become cooperative, and it wants to join with spirit more than other energies. This is just because of the nature of there being so many different kinds and so much of energy. It naturally selects itself. Some of it seeks to go into more involutionary or gravitational kinds of, we'll say, expressions of itself. Nothing wrong with that. That's fine. It's called involution of energy. And some of it really prefers to connect with energies that are more evolving and more spiritually inclined. And they kind of jump ship and want to, instead of going through the normal gravitating of energies and becoming bigger and bigger energies and developing large amounts of themselves, they actually become selective and want to actually try to develop more intelligent movement and to become, we'll say, connected to spirit in a much closer fashion, which is what produces life. There has to be some energy that connects better with spirit than the average energy does. Otherwise, life couldn't exist. There would be too big of a jump. And for life to exist, life has to have more intelligent activity and a balance between the energy in it, energy in the body and senses of life, and the spirit part of life to make it truly what we call alive, meaning conscious. It has to have some form of consciousness on its own. And in order to develop this consciousness, which is a part of the spirit, there has to be enough intelligent energies that are responding to each other in a sort of connected way. We call those senses. The senses have to be connecting together. Because you can have some senses that virtually don't do anything. Like even a stone could theoretically have a sense, but it doesn't have senses that are in movement, moving information back and forth, which we call energy. Energy is a form of also saying communication or information. And this energy isn't balanced with the thought inside the stone, so you don't end up with a living thing. Living things have to have the energy moving back and forth, and there's another little secret to this. They not only need it moving back and forth on one dimension, but a minimum of two dimensions. You might say, well, how come that's the case? Well, I'll have to get to that later because I'll confuse you if I go too deep in this because it gets kind of complicated. But for right now, we'll just say that it's needed. And as soon as you get the two-dimensional thing, like between the physical and the astral dimensions, you have energy moving in both directions, and it's moving between two or more, actually, most people say three or more centers. It could be two plus a borrowed one for some types of life. Then you actually do get life. And the energy that moves between the centers has a name to it. It has a couple of names to it. But the name that is connected with the spirit part of us that is connected to Earth and is a feminine energy, because Earth is kind of like a feminine existence, that, and I'll explain what that feminine part means in a few minutes, but that part that is moving about has a name. It actually has a name. And the name of that energy in the beginning of the development of life is called Chi. Yeah, Chi. And you may be familiar with that name because, you know, we use it in making certain kinds of herbal remedies, you know, Bai Chi, which has to do with remedies that come from plants, but it's the life energy of plants. That's a very interesting name, Chi. And Chi has a lot to do with this whole thing tonight, but it's not the whole ballgame. You know, but, you know, don't think that it is. The interesting part about this is that's just half of the equation. There's this Chi energy, and that's the beginning of the kinds of energy that comes from the Earth. There's a couple others that, in more advanced life forms, especially humans, come into play. But for right now, we'll just talk about the Chi. And then there's another kind of energy that's a more masculine energy that has to balance out the Chi. I'm going to explain why that's the case in a minute, but I'm going to give a name to that energy, and it's called prana. And there's really seven types of prana, seven kinds of prana. Four of them have to do with the prana of what is called the mundane form, and three of them have to do with the prana of, we'll call it, developing into the mind of God. And so, ultimately, you have seven kinds of prana, seven pranas, and there happens to be three kinds of the Chi energy, and in its native form, before it becomes Chi, the Chi energy is one of the energies called Kundalinis, the Kundalini energies, and it's the energy that is the most dense form, the most dense form of Kundalini found in the spiritual world, the spiritual dimension. That's where it starts off from. That happens to be, have a proclivity, has a desire, we'll say, inside of itself, has a thought inside of itself, to want to connect with spirit more than other kinds of energies that are found on the seventh subplane of the spiritual dimension. Hope you're following me. This is complicated, I know. But it's really cool because it's how the universe kind of gets started. And I find that just fascinating that this is how the progenesis of our universe evolves. It's just amazing. Okay, so this stuff is way beyond where we are in the physical world right now, and it's in a spiritual dimension, which is where human beings don't even exist. And from that dimension, great beings in that dimension kind of direct and help this energy to develop, this lowest form of kundalini, it actually has a name. It's called Pingala. Pingala. And that energy is drawn all the way from the spiritual dimension. It's way, way far in dimensional space beyond us. And it comes instantly into our dimension, the physical dimension. Also, some of it goes into the astral and the mental dimensions, but most of it goes in the physical. And when it gets to the physical dimension, it joins with the most advanced spirit of Earth, the most advanced spirit that is in and around physical Earth. Okay, wow. And astral Earth and mental Earth, too. And so when it connects with that spirit, it instantly becomes this chi. Becomes the chi. First, kundalini becomes the chi. Wow. And it has two different expressions of itself. In normal life, it just moves between senses and both minor and major senses in the bodies of any living thing. And it, as long as it is moving, it helps to coordinate information from one sense to the other, and from one sense in one dimension to a sense in another dimension. It does some amazing things. Did you ever wonder how it is that you have emotions and thought taking place at the same time you have physical actions, both inside your body and ones that you're taking on the outside, all taking place at the same time? Because this chi energy is connecting those bodies and the senses in those bodies, including the major centers, which we call chakras, and hundreds of minor centers, all together. Wow. This is purely amazing, the way it works. And the thing that's so neat about it is that it's like the most basic stuff at the beginning of life, developing into a highly complex being like us, or even a flea is amazingly complex when you see how all of the different energies are moving within it. Wow. And that's true of plants. They're not as complex, and they have very minimal astral issues, but some. So plants are alive as well. It's an incredible thing. Okay. So I'm going pretty fast here because I don't want to spend the whole show just going over this beginnings of energy. Yes, we could, and then you would probably understand it better, but we really wouldn't get to where I'd like to get to in tonight's show. And so this is going to be kind of more of an overview. Like I said, you can read more about it in Life's Meaning, and there's a whole array of other books that explain different parts of it. Some of them are accurate, and unfortunately, some of them are kind of inaccurate because people don't necessarily fully understand this, even though they may be, quote-unquote, metaphysical or spiritual writers. Okay, so let's continue on in our journey of trying to understand how life energy works. I think this is one of the coolest things. And it is just so remarkable that something so basic can produce so, we'll say, unbelievable variety and diversity of life. That's the thing it kind of thrills me to even discuss this, because it's so neat. Okay, so far we've got kundalini becoming the chi. The chi connects the centers and senses, provides, communicates information from one sense and center to another, and eventually that communicates with storage area, which we call brains in some life forms. And if it's a very advanced life form, like a human being, we then have a personality, which integrates the information together into knowledge. Wow. Just amazing. Amazing stuff. Okay. Now, let's talk about the pranas, because we've just dealt with the feminine side of how this works. Now, what's the difference between the feminine and the masculine and all that stuff? Okay. The feminine side has a proclivity to follow the thought of the more advanced, evolved energies that may have taken millions of years to get there. Remember, this kundalini becomes chi is like instantaneous stuff. But not so for the energy that makes up the centers themselves. Our senses and the centers that create the senses are composed of energies that have been evolving for millions of years to be able to get to the position where they're at. And what position is that? Instead of being involutionary, where they just want to get denser and denser and denser, they are truly evolutionary energies on the other side of the energy kingdom, we'll call it, that think to some extent. Some of them only think when they're collectively together, so they kind of are a collective consciousness. And they're called lunar devas. Lunar devas. That's the official name of those kind of energies. The reason they're called lunar is because their thought is really more or less the reflection of higher thought than it is that they're super creative. Okay? And they tend to be, I guess the best way to describe them is they tend to be extremely group conscious, but very, we'll say minimally, almost zero individual consciousness. So if you took a piece of these energies, you couldn't say, well, that energy is a blank blank, because it wouldn't have any individuality. It would just be part of the whole grouping of energies like it within our system. So within a center, all the energies within that center tend to think together as a group. And they formulate a consciousness based upon how the group is collectively thinking. Now, the thought of energy is, even evolutionary energy, is very, very minimal. I don't want you to think, oh, wow, the genius thought. Or something. No, nothing of nature. Okay. Now, eventually, these evolutionary energies that make up senses and do other important jobs in our bodies, including produce some of the brains and some creatures, et cetera, as storage and devices for information. Those energies have a kind of, we'll call it, mission. Their mission is to provide as accurate a sense as possible so that life grows more effectively, more efficiently, more abundantly than not. That's like their job. And they have this inner sense to do that. That is their, that's one of their big sub-senses, no matter what energy they are, unless they're contaminated by a spirit that is very dark, like an evil spirit. Yeah. And if the spirit of a life form is dark, it can convert these energies into not thinking that way anymore. But normally, that's all they think. They say, oh, yes, we want to live longer, get life more abundant. And eventually, they do that. But they're very concerned about the organism that they're in and not so concerned about other organisms outside of themselves, because that reality just doesn't permeate them. It's too big for them to be connected to, because they don't have individuality. They only know of the body that they're in, kind of thing. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that that's where they are in the evolutionary part of energy stuff. There's a even more advanced evolutionary energy. It's called solar devonic energy instead of lunar. And this energy has its own individual thought. And it only exists from the higher mental plane and beyond. But it can be part of a soul, like a human soul, or even in some cases an animal or plant soul. And it also can be an advanced being, which we refer to as an inner guide or solar angel. It can become like a great being in and of itself, because it's starting to develop its own individuality. These energies join into becoming an individual thinking energy of its own identity. It has an individual consciousness rather than collective consciousness. It knows that it's more than just a center in a body. It now knows it is a being. It has beingness. That's what's missing from the energies that are evolutionary but lunar, is they don't have the beingness. And remember, connecting these energies together, all of them, all the evolutionary energies are connected together by the Kundalini. Wow. And especially chi energy. In most people, it's chi. And in some people, there's a couple other Kundalinis that come into play as they advance themselves, which we'll talk about later. But I got to bring that up again. And so this is just an amazing system. And I hope you're following this, because I know it's complicated, and I don't want to lose people, but I'm sure some of you are scratching your heads. How many more things are you going to tell me? I can't keep it up. Well, you know, again, this is the shorthand version. I understand that this is a lot to absorb in a short period of time, and there are books you can read about this if you miss it, or you can re-listen to the show next week, you know, after we get it up there, and a few days from now, you can say, let me turn that show back on again. I want to hear more about it. So you have that option, which is cool. You can go to the radio station and listen to it. They have it on their site, or you can go to agelesswisdom.com and you can listen to it there. Radio station usually has it up first, so if you're really interested, go there first. Okay, so let's go on with our story. And so far, I hope you're staying with everything I've said. Now, the chi energy is feminine because it tends to follow the thoughts of the evolutionary divinic energy. So if the evolutionary divinic energy is doing its thing right, then the chi energy is just naturally flowing and doing its thing, and everything's hunky-dory. It's good. However, if there's some overriding thought coming from the personality of a person or some darker being trying to create it, then unfortunately, or the collective thought of some kind of serious disease kind of being, we'll call it bacteria or viruses or things that collectively grow into a large enough size, then you get a problem because the chi tends to follow, it's a feminine energy, tends to follow the lunar devas, which are communicating through the chi back and forth. But the problem becomes that if those energies are not working properly, the evolutionary lunar divinic energies, and the chi gets slowed down, stuck, doesn't move in the right directions, and the life energy, which animates this whole system, stops doing so, and people fall victim to aging, illness, you name it. Bad things start to happen. So that's one of the problems with the chi energy. And there's more to this whole story, because there's also the pranas. There's, again, four that only deal with form, three that deal with, they will call it, the mind aspect of God. And the seven pranas are critical, and they're most critical in the three lower worlds where we all exist into, and we physically are alive right now, but we still have an astral and a mental body that's alive in those dimensions simultaneously. So what are the pranas doing, and how come they're a masculine? What makes them masculine, whatever that means? Well, masculine denotes that the first part of God's mind is more prominent than the second. First part of God's mind, so it's a spirit. It defines how the spirit reacts to and with the energies in the body. And pranas reinforce the creative, purposeful sacrificial side of spirit. And they have a means of doing this in the body, which I will explain about. But they do this to, we'll say, make sure that beyond everything else, we are self-created. We are self-created. So without this pranic issue, the thing that would be missing from who and what we are and what all life is to be like God. And the first part of God is to be self-created. So prana's guarantee, or almost guarantee, that life will be self-created. And kundalini, that it becomes chi energy, does not do that. It guarantees that we will become conscious, but not necessarily self-created. That's a big difference. And for most people, they don't necessarily understand the difference, but you will if you keep listening for the next few minutes. So this is kind of a big deal. This is a very interesting part of defining life, is that life in God's thought process needs to be a reflection of God, and God created itself, and it created life to add to its own beingness. And in so doing, life takes on the character of God, which is to be self-created. But in order for that to take place, the energy that connects the intelligent actions or the unintelligent actions of a life form has to be both self-created and conscious. Now you say, well, what do you mean by self-created? I mean, how does energy create itself? I mean, that sounds like some kind of amazing thing. Huh? Okay, so let's go through that process. Prana comes from the sun. That's where its original source of, we'll say, existence can be found, is from the sun. And the sun pours prana out, this special kind of energy, onto the earth. And it progenerates all life. And, of course, if you're familiar at all with biology, et cetera, you know that without the sun, there wouldn't be life, because the sun provides changes in the atmosphere. It provides protection in some ways from certain cosmic rays and other things. And most importantly, it provides the energy upon which the plant kingdom is found. And that's the beginnings of all life on Earth. Is the first true life comes from the plant kingdom, not from minerals. Minerals provide a lot of added factors, but the sun provides the need for the kind of energy that progenerates life. Now let's get deeper into this thought process, because this is going to get a little bit complicated for us. Okay, so then you say, well, okay, well, what is that life? What is that energy doing that causes progenerating energy in comparison to the energy that is just conscious building? Because we knew that by connecting the information in centers, we start building consciousness. As long as the centers are joined and you have at least two dimensions represented, in this case, the beginning, the physical, and what we call the emotional to some extent, then you can start talking about life having sentiency. Okay? Sentiency means that it has some ability to recognize its own existence and the existence of other life as well. So that's a really cool thing. Sentiency is built on consciousness. But that comes from the chi energy, which we already covered. What is the pranic energy doing that's so incredibly important that is missing from the chi energy? Well, the pranic energy allows the life form to choose which one of the chi energy information streams of information to listen to or not listen to, which ones to combine together or to separate apart, which ones to question or to take as absolute information, which ones to synthesize and to extrapolate and eventually to invent new ways of thinking, and new ways of thinking and new ways of assuming possible information that does not yet exist. So this is what the Pranas do. You can say, wow, how did they do that? That's pretty cool stuff. But that's what all life does, you see. Life has all those great abilities. And how does the Pranas do that? Well, the way the Pranas do that is a pretty fascinating process. They don't dictate to life how to think, because the thinking part is the spirit part. What they do is they allow spirit to draw upon the Pranas to attract other spirit. Spirit is just the thought. So the spirit that we think of that is within us is really an amorphous thing. It's not like just a single spirit and that's it. Spirit is like in flux. It moves. And if pranic energy is available, the spirit part of life can draw upon other spirits from all kinds of sources, by the way, to bring new ways of thinking based upon the experiences of this other spirit that exists in different parts of form. So you start becoming almost like super conscious by doing this, and prana provides the ability to do that because the prana moves in and out of a human being in a fashion which is almost hard to comprehend, and even in the lowest forms of life, it does so very, very easily and very quickly. Prana has the ability to move spirit. It has the ability to keep spirit in one place if that's what the spirit wants, or it has the ability to move the spirit from one place to another if the spirit chooses to do that. It gives spirit the choice to be. And it does so by allowing spirit to be mobile, by jumping from one form to another form within any similar or same dimensional part of space. So this is an amazing thing. Now, in order to fully grasp this, and we're gonna take a break in a minute here, but in order to fully grasp this, it's almost impossible to understand it except in more basic terms because it's so esoteric to most people. Think of it this way. That prana is the food of spirit and chi is the food of energy. It's an energy itself, and both prana and chi are energies. But prana is the food that spirit needs to animate itself. And if you become chronically deprived over days, weeks, months of time, the ability to move spirit in and out becomes less and less, and the person's ability to make new choices and to think in ways that are self-creating diminishes, so the person's life literally starts going down the tubes because they aren't self-creative enough to stay alive eventually. So that's a danger of not having enough prana. And we'll get to that, too, in tonight's show and how that can manifest itself. Okay, when we come back, I'll go back over some of this and I'll explain more about prana because that's a really hard one. It's a real hard one. And then I'll explain some of the more, give some more concrete examples of it so that you can understand it better, hopefully. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a break right now. And we'll come back in about 2.5 minutes or so from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the energy of life, energies of life, actually, but it's, depending upon how you look at it, there's a lot of different ways to say energy and explain it. Now, when I finished during that first segment, I probably left some of you scratching your head and you say, well, wait a second. Energy of spirit? But spirit is separate from energy. Okay. I'm going to explain it. See, we're talking about those chakras, the major chakras, and the minor chakras, and all this stuff, right? Okay, you see, in each major chakra, there is not just energy. There is a spirit sphere as well. There's an energy sphere and a spirit sphere. And a spirit sphere has to be, a spirit has to be able to move in and out of the spirit sphere of each one of our major centers, which is also a major sense in each body. And then it's connected together through two, we'll call it, components of spirit. Those components of spirit are called a thread. And the thread is composed of one of the three higher, pranas. There's three pranic energies. Actually, the third ray, second ray, and first ray, for those of you who understand the rays. Of energy that connects together with these consciousness spheres, I mean consciousness threads, and the thread of life, it's called life thread. And there's two kinds of life thread, one that connects to the physical or to the form side, and one that connects to the God side. It's a little complicated for that side. But anyway, so you have the three pranas that they work in composition with the spirit and allow the spirit to move in and out of the body and to connect to various sources depending upon how and where the consciousness is moving, because the consciousness provides direction, but the life thread in two ways provides either choices or it provides resistance to change. Either change or resistance to change. It sort of works as a plus and minus to change. And so you end up with the ability for spirit itself to move in and out of a body and to either keep a body alive, or if it moves completely out of the body, or at least out of one whole center, the body dies. And it's the first three highest of the pranas that provides the source for the spirit to be able to move. Because spirit has no, it's just thought. It can't do anything without some energy associated with it, so the pranas provide that. Are you following me? Okay, hopefully you are, because I know this is complicated. And some of this is really often to, we'll say, it's a complicated regions of esoteric understanding. Also, I don't know that all of this has been explained in one source before. Even in the book I wrote, Lights and Meaning, some of it never got completely explained because it just ran out of room. But at any rate, so this is the way that spirit gets around, so to speak. Now you could say, well, what about those other four pranas? What are they doing? Well, the other four pranas specialize spirit towards specific centers, whereas the higher three pranas allow spirit to become unspecialized in some respects, especially the first two. And so it gives less specialty and more flexibility to the spirit, whereas the four lowest gives the spirit sort of a fixed nature when connected to a chakra. Now you might say, well, what about those hundreds of other centers? How do they work? Do they get prana directly and do all this stuff? No, they don't. They have to get their prana processed through connecting with one of the major centers, because they cannot directly take in the prana without being connected. There's a thing called the spleen center, which kind of has a specialty in being able to connect to more than one center, but it still has got to be connected to a major center, and it isn't major in itself. So it's a very interesting thing about this, is that the prana is critical to eventually keeping us alive, but beyond just keeping us alive, it allows us to become self-created. If we didn't have pranas, we would become less and less able to make choices, because the spirit would become frozen in each center, and we wouldn't be able to enlighten our spirit. As a matter of fact, the spirit would gradually become darker and darker and darker, and a condition that happens in evil people called crystallization would occur. Because there'd be no improvement in the spirit, it would be de-evolving, so to speak. And instead of using prana, the only way evil people stay alive is they steal, think of it this, the energies, and not pranic energies, they steal the chi energies from those that they victimize. Wow. They don't really live on solar energy, which is the sun's energy. So it's a very weird thing that they do, very weird. And they live, they live basically as like vampires, so taking energies from us. Not blood so much, but energy itself. So this is a pretty cool idea if you think about it, because it allows the system to be self-created, self-motivated or non-motivated. It allows a continual growth in most life, with some life able to choose, if it wants to not grow and to even become crystallized in darkness and to not move at all, to be some kind of terrible thing. It gives that option to life. And especially as the life becomes more developed, the options become greater, because you get more centers. The more centers, the more spirit can move between the centers, the more pranic energies are being used at one time. Humans use all seven of the pranic energies. They eventually can use all three of the kundalinis, the chi being the first, but the other two I'll tell you more about. And so we have this is amazing options for being self-created. Now, I got to tell you, you know, you take a fly or something, you're not going to have near as many options. So flies are not that self-created. So one fly happens to be very much like another fly, in comparison to a human being, at least. Are there differences from one fly to another? Yes. They're very slight and small, and unless you're a fly, you may not notice them. But the point is that all life has the ability to be somewhat eventually differentiated and special. But human life is that we got it all together. With all, we have seven senses, which is all seven of the different ray types of energy exist within us. We can deal with all seven pranas. These are actually, like, some people call it sub-pranic energies. Each one is a specialized prana. We can deal with the chi energy, and then the other two energies that are the part come from the kundalinis as well. And this is the amazing thing about us. We have the most ability to be of all life up to us, to be self-created, and to become more godlike. As a matter of fact, because we have all this going for us, we have two senses that help us. One helps us to understand God, our own creator, and the other is to become and seek to become more of God. And that's the heart chakra helps us to understand God, and the crown chakra helps us to become more of God. And if we didn't have two major centers fully active in us, both in consciousness with the spirit sphere and in form, then we wouldn't be able to sense God, and we wouldn't be human. By definition, that's what makes us human, and guess what? That is way different than evolution, if you think about it. The evolutionary process, as defined by most evolutionary biologists, puts us in a spectrum or a line where we just evolve from one place of, we'll say, apes to a super kind of ape to us, without understanding the critical differences in how humans work, because we are able to use the energy of life in a much more complicated and much more effective means, so that the life we're developing is far more creative of our creator and far more interesting and meaningful than any of the lower life forms, even the ones closest to human are. We're very different from any other kind of, what we'll call it, just animal. And we're not an animal. Human beings have very significant differences in animals. Okay, so this is really cool. I kind of like it. Now that we understand how these energies are starting to work in us, you can see that there's really a kind of a madness to this craziness. A pattern or an explanation to the craziness and madness that sounds like all these energies just running around. They actually are there to produce within us the characteristics of our creator. And they're a genius design, beyond genius. They're a godly design that you can spend probably the rest of this life and every other life you're going to have trying to figure out a better one, and I don't think you're going to come up with one, because this is truly a remarkable one. It really works. And it's so, so incredibly intelligent, and so incredibly, we'll say, expressive and revealing of God. So to understand how these energies work is to really understand part of the mind of God. That's why I'm speaking about it tonight. Not because I think that everybody should have some kind of metaphysical, anatomical energy definition of how human beings exist or how any life exists, but because it brings us so much closer to our Creator, if you get it. Now, for those of you who say, well, I want to know more, read chapter 7. That's probably the chapter in Life's Hidden Meaning. That will help you to kind of put together what I'm talking about tonight and with more, you know, we'll say, knowledge than I can impart in a small time period. You can then join it together with some of the bigger concepts that I expressed tonight, a few of which are actually not fully developed in Chapter 7, you can kind of get a whole new viewpoint on this process, which I think in and of itself is just brilliant, brilliant. Okay, so now we got the basics of life energy. Now we got chi energy, which is one of the three kinds of feminine energies that can lead to energy developing, helping to develop higher consciousness in spirit. Wow. And then we've got pranic energies, which helps us to, first of all, understand ourselves and be self-created, and then eventually to become understanding of God or others, and then God, souls we'll call it, and then the God, and be more creative of souls and creative of God and life itself. Wow. In human beings, this is true. Now, of lower life, they just... The lower life can never become fully creative, more self-created of God, creating itself into God directly, but it can understand things like love. It can eventually understand other life and have a great sense of life that's mostly similar to itself in some ways. That's a good thing, and that's because it's of the pranic energies, but it doesn't have all seven of them, especially all seven balanced, so that it can do it like a human being can. Wow. Pretty amazing. Now let's talk about that energy part that is also directing spirit, and it develops into a thing called a thread. I want to describe this for you so you can understand it better. Think of it this way. A thread is like not really a thing. It's the inflow and outflow consistently and in a very rhythmic way of spirit, hopefully slightly improving the spirit every so often, like in a rhythmic way. And it's directed by pranic energies. And the reason that the pranic energies are able to direct the spirit to do this is because the spirit needs the pranic energies in order to move at all. So it has to, it provides the spirit the ability to move in and out of bodies, because it itself is moving in and out of bodies. And in a way, the best way to describe it is that the spirit's kind of hitching a ride on the type of pranic energy that it's identifying with. And it's a real kind of strange thing that energy is following thought, but in some ways, spirit is following the thought of some of the pranic energies. It's kind of like a symbiotic relationship, and it's like forming this thread, it's called, which is a thread not made out of form, but it's a thread made out of pranic energies following and being followed, both at the same time, spirit energy that is hopefully enlightening itself in the process and creating either a life thread, which provides more choices, or in some cases, restriction of choices, where the choices are becoming harmful to a being, and or it's also providing consciousness, which is the ability to understand oneself in relationship to others, and the ability to combine information in ways that leads to a wider connection of association with more and more things. So you could say consciousness is the ability to see yourself connected to more and more of everything that isn't yourself. I like that definition, but it kind of makes it feel kind of funny. But anyway, so that's a cool way of looking at it. And these threads, therefore, it's hard to understand them because they are threads of light in most people. The light may not be pure white light, but in most people, you see the threads as just a light, as light of some sort connected to the various centers that are major centers in both the body that you may be looking at, but also connected to a higher body, like the astral or mental body. The centers in those bodies are interconnected through the thread as well. Now, where does the threat originate from? It originates from the spiritual plane, and it came from a thing called a monad, because the monad kind of separated itself into the original energy and spirit that's on the spiritual plane. So it's kind of a very fascinating process, just an amazing process, really. And when we look at this, the best way to understand it is that the light in the spirit in most people, some people it's darkness, and that's not a good thing, but the light in the spirit is both a thing, you can think of it that way, and a form, and it's also kind of like a spirit wave of sorts, because it's moving. And if you're familiar at all with quantum physics, this is completely consistent with our understanding of the fundamental nature of everything. Everything is both a thing, a particle form, and it's a wave at the same time. And it also has, if you were to apply the physics principles, it also has some element of consciousness, but it also has an element of being probabilistically self-created. In other words, it makes choices beyond or within itself and beyond the environment that it's in. Just amazing stuff, because there's actually interconnection of some of the fundamental bases of physics in comparison to metaphysics. And that's a whole other subject. And I realize that pulls us way away from what I was just talking about. I just like to throw these things in there when I'm in one of these moods. Anyway, I'm going to let you cool down. I'm starting to cool down a little bit here. Someone just turned on the air conditioning. But also be aware that we'll come back to this, and that we're going to go into some of the more practical understanding of pranic energies, chi energy, eventually kundalinis, and how this whole thing is interconnected into what it means to be alive and have meaning in life and all kinds of other stuff. But we'll get to that in a minute or two. I want to tell you about an experience I had a few days ago. I was out doing something and picking up some stuff, and while I was waiting for that stuff to be available, I went into a place called Grimaldi's Brick Oven. It's just a pizza place here in Phoenix. And for those of you who have anything to do with Phoenix, or you occasionally, you know, may visit here, you might want to try their pizza. It was really quite good. And the place I was at was called Santan Village. It's not exactly around where I necessarily live, but I happen to be in the neighborhood, so I dropped in. And I walked in at the time when some really, I'll say, boisterous young children, accompanied by their mothers, and some infants and toddlers, et cetera, were all coming in at the same time. Some of these women knew each other, so it was like a barrage, and they were coming in for an early lunch, actually. And as I walked in, I guess I kind of fit in with the crowd, you know. And so for a few minutes, I was standing there waiting to get seated while they were trying to figure out what to do with this big group of people. They just thought I was part of the group, which is funny. I probably could have been the grandfather of these kids, but that's okay. At any rate, that was kind of a little bit of a mix-up. And the manager of the restaurant, her name was Rebecca, she was a little bit concerned. I was standing there for 5 minutes waiting to get seated, but I said, oh, no problem. And then I ordered a pizza there, and as I said, ultimately the pizza is really delicious. The first one came out a little bit undercooked. I said, well, it needs to be more. I cooked it a little bit more. And so I had to wait because there was all these people that had already ordered their pizzas, so I was waiting for a while for my pizza to come back because they made me a new one. It's hard to put an old pizza back in the oven. And I got it back, and it was just terrific, terrific pizza. And the manager said, look, you know, really sorry. We want you to come back. I would have come back anyway, but that's okay. Why don't you come back? She said, this meal's on us. And I said, well, yeah, it's terrific. I just hoped that she wasn't going to end up paying for it out of her own pocket or something. And she wasn't. But the main thing is that they were very nice. I thought they were trying to do the right thing, even though some of what happened was, in a way, no one's fault. No, no, really, I can't say, well, that person did this, this person did this. Just the circumstances took place. And so I just want to make mention, because sometimes when people do good things in this world, they really don't see any immediate rewards. And I think that the overall attitude in this restaurant was one that the customer came first, and it doesn't matter whether they made any money off of me or not or whatever. They want to make sure that I was satisfied and I was happy. And they had no idea I was going to say this on the show tonight. Not before they give me a pizza or anything. I told them I was going to do something about it, which is tonight. But the thing is that it was delicious pizza. And if you want to enjoy yourself and go to a place, although I wouldn't recommend you stand behind about a dozen kids. Don't want to be seated with their mothers. That's probably not going to be the fun part of the experience. But the rest of the place was delightful and terrific. And ultimately, it all turned out fine. And I didn't have a time issue either. So it wasn't like I was in some way tremendously delayed because I was waiting for something. So it didn't matter anyway. And the people there were just amazingly friendly, and they made me a great pizza. Grimaldi's Brick Oven over in Santan Village. And if you have a chance, drop in. I think they have 7 other restaurants generally in the Phoenix area. I don't know if they have any others outside of Phoenix. But great pizza. They cook the pizza in up to a 1,400-degree oven. I think my mind got lost on the cold side of the oven, they told me. No, they really did say that. But at any rate, that that gives the pizza the ability to be crisp and at the same time not burned, which is a hard thing to do with pizzas these days. And it's made in a brick oven rather than a steel oven, because brick radiates the food better. It gets a consistency that's hard to get in any other kind of oven. Grimaldi's. Okay. I just thought you'd like to know about that little experience and let your brains cool off as we're coming back to talk more about some of this really esoteric stuff tonight. All right. So let's get back to the threads. I didn't quite finish what I was trying to get to on the threads. All right, so the threads interconnect the physical and the astral and the monastic bodies of a human being, but they also connect us to our soul and to, we'll say, the soul's alter ego. Some people refer to it as the oversoul, and which is really an energy being. That's an oversoul is just a being made out of solar divinic energies. It doesn't have any energies that aren't solar. So it's a tremendously great thinking being in itself. And then eventually all the way back to this thing called that monad, which our soul individually is connected to one of those beings too. So amazingly, there's this whole connection through spirit and light, as the spirit is enlightening itself, from the most godly of existences, the monad, about as close as you're going to get to God and still be human being, and us. Now, most people don't realize that this connection actually exists, and they think that they're very distant and separated from God. Well, they're not. We are very connected to a host of very great beings, all the way to the one of the greatest of all beings in our universe. And this is a tremendous we'll say, advantage for the human being especially is that we can become fully conscious of this. Now, you might say, well, what do you mean fully conscious? Well, as a human being develops itself, it eventually doesn't just work off of that chi energy. The chi energy, I'm going to give you a lot more information about chi energy and practicality. We're also going to talk about feng shui and other things that deals with it. But the chi energy is not just there to allow us to communicate within ourselves. Eventually, it's there to allow us to connect to all the parts of us that are beyond human, including our soul, our oversoul, which is like a helping soul of a greater standard. And eventually, there's three parts to the oversoul. You can imagine that they're even more exalted in its development, so it's kind of like a triple being. And then eventually to a thing called a monad, which is like the word monad means the one. It's the closest thing to the experience of God itself. And there are four levels of development to reach each one of those beings at various levels of consciousness. And those four things that do that are called initiations on Earth. We do it this way. There's other ways of doing it, but we do it through this level of initiation. And the initiations are just levels of service. How much are you willing to serve God and all other life around you in ways to help it become more godly? And as you do that, you move up the consciousness wagon, so to speak. You move up the levels of light and through the threads that I talked about of spirit, connecting us eventually to these other beings and living a little bit of their lives while we live our life as a human. So we live more and more as a soul while we continue to live as a human, and eventually has a solar angel kind of being at the same time. And it has three levels, and eventually get to learn about and live some of those. And then eventually we, at various stages of these initiations, called the fully accepted stage, where you have a lot of leadership responsibilities and creative responsibilities, you become more and more, for brief periods, like your monad, until you finally just leave the human kingdom and become a liberated soul, which is some even beyond a normal human soul's existence, because you and the soul become one. This is just an amazing process, and it's all done by using not just the chi energy, which is the pingala, or first of the kundalini, which is actually the third or lowest of the developing kundalini. It's weird, I know. And some esoteric books make mention of this, but nobody quite understands it. What do they mean that it's reversed? The names are really kind of reversals of themselves, because Pingala, while it is the first energy, it's actually the last. It's weird. But it's the one we use first. And then there's another energy called Ida. What is Ida energy? Ida energy is the energy that develops the most consciousness in us by connecting the consciousness thread to the soul, the solar angel, or to the oversoul, and its three parts, and eventually to the monad. And then there's an energy called Shushuma, which is an energy which eventually gives us the ability to create, not just be conscious, but be self-created into the being. And when you use the Shushuma energy, then it joins the other two energies together, kind of like a serpent fire, and it twists it around. And that causes all of the centers, the major centers, in each of the bodies to fuse together, and eventually three human bodies, the physical, or etheric physical, the astral, and the mental, to join all together, become one. And then you're no longer a human being, you're a soul, but a liberated soul, and you're called some people call them masters, or some people call them a member of the kingdom of souls, of advanced being. You're something way beyond human. You may still look human if you choose to, but you're beyond human. And that takes hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes, and lots of people say they've already done that, and they just walk around thinking they have, but of course they haven't. This great experience, though, is a result of using the energy of life to its maximum effect for a human being and producing, self-creating us into a higher part of God. Changing our life into a higher part of life through the energy of life. Pretty neat. Great idea. All right, so you've got all the kind of pieces of the puzzle, baby. a lot of different pieces going on. And let's talk a little bit about the pranic energies, because this is kind of a little strange. As a person becomes more and more creative in a spiritual sense of creating more of themselves into God, they start using the 3 out of the 7 highest pranic energies more and more, and they need less and less food. And you can say, well, why? Well, see, food is just what food is for a human being, or just any kind of life form, is a way of holding on to stale prana, I call it. It's prana that really isn't moving anymore until we put it in our bodies, digest it, and then it gets to move again. And we can store it for a short period of time, relatively, before it destroys itself. And then once we eat it, we have to use it up fairly quickly. But it's how human beings in physical form gain some of the prana that they need. It's how we, and the reason we have to do that is because we are making so many mistakes and we're doing so many selfish things that we can't get enough prana from the surrounding air, because prana is part of the air, part of our whole world, actually. And we can't get enough just from the air because we expend too much, we waste too much energy. So we have to eat, because eating is a densified form of prana. It usually starts with plants, although, of course, the animals can eat the plants and then we can eat the animals. But then the prana is changed by the nature of the animal. And when prana is changed by the nature of the animal, the efficiency of the prana becomes less capable of enlightening, but more capable of sustaining the basic elements of life. So if you eat meat, it's easier to keep your physical body going, but at the cost of developing higher consciousness and light in your threads, because the prana doesn't move as much. It's stale prana. And it's very stale when by the time it gets into an animal, because that animal got it eventually from either eating other animals or eating that eventually had originally ate plants. Better to eat the plants, as they say, than to eat the animals. But that's another story, right? And it doesn't help you to not eat animals if you can't sustain your physical body. So if you're not nutritionally minded enough, and et cetera, you're probably better off just eating meat than eating the wrong kinds of vegetarian foods, because you can get prana deprived from that, and that could cause illnesses and lots of problems. As you eat less and less prana, you also, or as you consume less prana from the air, you become less creative, and that's a big problem. Prana is also absorbed through the hair. Isn't that weird? Yeah, it comes through the hair on your body. There's the 7 kinds of prana that come through the hair. There's subtle, very subtle forms of each prana that come through the hair only, or mostly. And for people who are bald, they always have a little more of a problem with this. But as you grow more hair, you can become more creative, but you have to be careful, because if you don't use the prana in a creative way that's virtuous, then it becomes destructive in your body and chaotic. Isn't that weird? So if you grow your hair real long and you're very creative and virtuous, that's okay. But if you don't grow your hair very If you do grow your hair very long and you're selfish, you're going to have a chaotic kind of life because the energies will become chaotic in you, and instead of being self-created, you'll be self-destructive. Wow, isn't that strange? I mean, I told you I was going to say some things that are pretty unusual in this segment. So, yeah, that's odd stuff, I know. And it gets complicated because it even what your the color of your hair reflects in frequency the different pranic values. And even if you dye your hair, this is weird, it actually will change the percentage of which prana you're getting. So, weird as it sounds, dyeing your hair actually has a slight effect on the way in which you're going to be creative in your life or self-destructive. That's a strange thing. Who would believe that? According to what I understand, that's the way it works. Yeah. Okay. I don't know if that's good or bad for the people who sell hair dye or whatever, or dye people's hair for them. All right. So, so that's a little aside, I know. There's so much to talk about, and I'm not going to be able to explain everything about this subject tonight by any stretch. I'm going into the interesting and quirky and somewhat, we'll say, definitive understandings of this whole subject, but I can't tell you everything about it. All right, so what are some of the other important elements about needing prana? Well, let's say that you took yourself and put yourself in a cave somewhere, and you got no direct air infiltration in the cave. It was all the air in the cave was from canisters of air that were filled years ago, and that's the only air you had, or maybe there's a big enough space that you're just using the air that was available there from a long time ago. And you get no other direct air from no prana, and you eat very little fresh food. The process would be, over time, one that became self-destructive because you would lose your ability to create more of yourself in the beginning of the process. Yourself would diminish, actually. But the thing that's worse about it is that the body would quickly diminish in its capacity to stay alive. Wow. Isn't that strange? And so prana, over weeks and even months, or I should say months and even weeks of time, as you get deprived of it, can lead to illness and serious problems. The same is somewhat true of qi, but qi has some very different issues. Qi lowers consciousness. So a person's ability to understand would be decreased. And then qi works in a different way. Instead of being self-destructive, it allows, when the qi energy gets low, it allows other things like disease elements and parasites and sometimes possessing entities, which is another whole other subject, to come in and occupy your bodies. Ooh, doesn't sound too cool, huh? So when people get low qi, they can become possessed by all kinds of things, everything from various disease organisms and parasites to you name it. It could be a possessing entity from another dimension or a ghost from the etheric part of this dimension. Bad stuff can happen to you when you don't have enough qi. And you literally are attacked from the inside out. Oddly, a person could be low on qi and still be okay in their prana. So they could be still okay in self-creation while they're dying of bad illnesses. Although, the tendency is that if you become self-created and virtuous, then that gets the qi better organized because the devonic energies in your natus system, in your etheric body, which is like the electromagnetic part of your nervous system, start responding better, and then the qi improves in terms of its movement through the body. It doesn't get stuck in one spot, which is always a bad thing and creates illnesses. And its movement is more free, and therefore information is moved from one center to another quickly, more quickly and more easily. Consciousness grows. And people then usually heal themselves very quickly if they can understand the qi process. I might as well go into that right now in terms of talking about healing, because that's a very practical issue. Generally speaking, if you're trying to heal somebody, you need to work on both sides of the fence, the feminine side dealing with the qi. And if they're an advanced person, you also have to balance out the Ida and the Shishuma in their system, or they won't get well. Because the more advanced you are, the more difficult it is to get well if you've made yourself sick by being selfish. I know that sounds terrible, but that's true. Because you have to balance not one energy, you have to balance the other two, depending upon your level of advancement, so they can get very complicated and take more time and be a lot more resistant to improvement over time. Okay, so you want to be careful with that, because as you advance your consciousness, you advance your service, if you start becoming selfish for whatever reason, the consequences are considerably greater on you. Not because there's somebody standing in the corner going to hit you over the head with something. It's self-regulated by the way the physics of the qi energy and the bodies and pranic energies all work together. So you can see that you don't need somebody punishing you. You punish yourself in this system. Okay, so if you want to improve your health, then you need to balance out the qi energy. And some suggestions are, qi energy doesn't just come from the earth, starts there, but it also comes from anything that comes from the earth, including other people, other things, and things that are low in qi energy are usually things that human beings have tampered with. Some forms, such as certain kinds of artificial materials, some kinds of plastics, are not good for us to have close contact with because they have low qi energy. The qi in them has been stupefied. It's not moving very well. And if we surround ourselves with it, it could be a negative kind of energy. Better to use things that are high in qi, and those kinds of things usually come from things that used to be literally alive, rather than things that are composed from things that were never alive. Okay? So that's one of the concerns you might want to have if you want to improve your health. The other is that you might want to get a book on feng shui, although some of them are not very good. But feng shui tells you the nine ways that qi energies can move through the environment, and that you can change those in these nine different ways. Some people, some systems have different numbers to them. And then by keeping the qi energy moving through the environment, it moves in and out of your body more easily, and you have a greater resource of it, and it doesn't draw it into one center or another because of an imbalance in the environment, and that will lead to a higher level of health. Pranic energies come from the sun. So you want to make sure that you have fresh air. You see, the sun method of getting into it usually is through the atmosphere. And you want to make sure you have fresh water, because prana also enters into water. And prana also comes into anything that has direct contact with the outside atmosphere. Anything that has direct contact with the outside atmosphere is where you're concerned about prana. And you want to make sure that the light that you have has some natural light in it. And if you're using artificial light, try to use one that is closer to natural light. Difficult, I know. It's not easy to follow these recommendations because we do so much as human beings to counter them. And we don't even realize that we're not living right until it's too late and we're sick. Okay, so you want to have prana, and you want to have a balance of the prana with the qi. You don't want to have an excessive amount of qi and a low amount of prana, or a high amount of prana, low amount of qi. You want to have them balanced, and you want to have them in movement. Anytime you're not moving, you're in trouble. Okay? The other thing that helps to get prana going is to be, we'll say, focused out in service, and creative. Make sure that you're creative. If you're not creative and you're always following others and trying to figure out what others are doing and what you know, trying to get someone else to tell you what to do and how to do it, that's not a good thing because it will reduce the amount of prana imbalance in your system, and that can lead to problems. And on the chi side, you want to be conscious. So you want to be inner reflective. You want to do meditation. You want to be loving and giving to others and figure out the best ways that you can give to others so they can become more giving themselves. That keeps the chi moving well. Wow. And the other two kundalinis if you're more advanced in your development. So these are some of the more, we'll say, helpful ways to stay well and to stay healthy using these energies of life. Really cool stuff, I think. All right, so let's talk about some other practical issues. Since feng shui is a real science, in my opinion, then the environment we put ourselves in, including the people around us, has a direct effect on these energies. And if you're around people who are very selfish and you're not trying to help them to become unselfish, then you're prone to developing the negative energy they already have and to becoming affected by their negative energy. So unless you're in service to people, you're not protected from them. You become victimized by them. And that doesn't mean you should just run away from everybody that's, you know, selfish. But unless you can serve them in some way, you shouldn't be around them. If you can serve them, you need to be around them because you can be a servant. So it's up to them. You can't force people to be served by you. And if people don't want your service, then get the heck away from them because they're going to be toxic and problematic. People also have a tendency to develop a lot of negative, we'll say, energies from their lifestyle. Smoking is a negative energy. It cancels out both of the... It's one of the worst things you can do because it cancels out both prana and chi at the same time. Not good. The only thing you can say about it is it does balance the two to a lower and lower level, and it keeps them in balance. That's where some smokers like that feeling of being balanced, but at a tremendous cost in consciousness and creativity. We talked about eating meat. Well, if you eat meat, it tends to imbalance you. You will tend to need a lot more prana, and you'll have too much chi stuck in various parts of your body, especially your colon, so because the sacral center is tremendously affected by eating meat. And so that may not be such a good thing for you. It will also depreciate your spleen center, which is not a major center, but it's sometimes connected to the sacral center, causing you to get ill more often. A lot more illness is likely. If you eat a lot of meat, especially, if that could be a problem for you. What are some of the other elements that you can change? Well, what you wear, your form of dress. If you surround yourself with beauty, I'll get back to the clothes in a second. If you surround yourself with beauty, the beauty itself improves your senses and the senses of others. Now, beauty is anything that improves senses. So you'll know that something is beautiful because your senses are working better. And you know that you're surrounded by something that's ugly when your senses are working worse. Now, I know some people have different definitions of beauty, but that's the basic one that I would prefer that you use because it's the one that's practical. And then if we're talking about clothes, apply that same principle. The clothes should allow prana to enter and exit fairly easily. And at the same time, they should employ some element of beauty to them. And they should be comfortable because without comfort, there's stress on the body, and it annoys the demonic energies, and that affects the way the chi moves in the body. And that causes a lot of other problems. So if you wear uncomfortable clothing, you decrease the movement of the chi in your system, and that's going to create more likelihood of illnesses as well as a lowering in consciousness. You didn't think that your clothes could lower consciousness? Well, yeah, they can. Okay. And for people who say, well, good, I'm a nudist, I don't wear clothes. Well, let's just hope that your body's beautiful enough so that's not going to be a problem. Okay. But because clothes can add to the beauty of the body, and it can compensate for the fact that, true, if you're not wearing clothes, you're not going to have the problem with uncomfort or discomfort, at least not in any physical sense, and you're not going to have as much restriction and a lot of other factors, but you may actually decrease your beauty. So the trade-off here is to consider all elements when you're talking about the advantage of nudity versus clothing. Kind of an interesting thought, isn't it? Most people, I realize, do not consider these things when they go out shopping. Gee, I wonder, should I be a nudist or should I wear some clothes? And what, should I increase my beauty or not? The thing you've got to be very careful about is not wearing things that make you look ugly. Now, why is that the case? Because when you do that, you invite the chi energy in the environment to slow down and to become centralized around areas of your body that are most ugliest from whatever you're wearing, and the result will be an increase in illness in those areas especially, and a decrease in consciousness. And that becomes circular. People with lower consciousness dress ugly, do ugly things to their body, and then that lowers their consciousness more, and they go get 4 more tattoos, and they'll pierce this and that, and they'll, before long, they'll be wearing some very ugly clothing, too. Now, again, ugliness is anything that decreases your senses and the senses of others around you, and beauty does the reverse. Don't think I'm using some kind of self-determined value to that. Yes, I don't think, in most cases, that piercings or tattoos improves the beauty of a body. I think that those are affectations caused by people's need for improvement in identity with a group rather than to be self-developed. That's a whole other psychology principle, and we don't have to get into that for right now. But I don't think, it's a terrible thing. It's just that it doesn't add to the beauty of the body in most circumstances. Could it? Well, possibly, but most of them don't. And most of the kinds of piercings that people do are not really like that. And there are other factors that come into play that even if you had the most beautiful tattoo in the world, what will it look like 5 years from now? So you have to consider this in a more long-term situation. Clothes you can take on and off, and as they wear out, you can discard them or use them for rags or give them to someone who doesn't need beautiful clothes, at least. They just need to stay warm. But tattoos and some piercings, you can't just undo that easily. Or other kinds of body affectation uses. So all these things come into play. And let's get back to hair for a minute because I went over that pretty fast in the practical value. Hair affects the pranas. We know that. Okay. But there's a difference between males and females. This is really weird. Females, hair attracts mostly astral pranas in comparison to physical or etheric physical and mental pranas. It's kind of a strange thing, but it does. Now, why is that? Well, it's so complicated, I'm not even sure I have the time to explain it tonight. It really has to do with the fineness of the keratin, the protein in the hair, and the way that it deals with the atmosphere around it. That fineness, it just happens to frequency-wise, work very well with astral energies, and not so well with etheric energies, which is connected to the physical. Or the too fine mental energies, which do not virtually are not, the hair is not receptive to them at all. So it's just sort of, think of it as an antenna. Hair is an antenna that's really good about astral energies in the pranic sense. Well, here's the weird thing about it. Women are very good at exploiting this. They did better than men. So if they get more of the astral energy, become more creative, more often than not, they can use the extra pranic energy to do something that is truly creative rather than destructive. But when men tend to grow their hair longer in comparison to women, and if they change it to weird colors, the results can be the opposite. They can become more self-destructive. Good thing, huh? And as ages have gone by, where men would have either long hair or short hair, in the times when men had longer hair, they tended to be more destructive to themselves and the selves of others. And it's kind of the reverse is true with women, where women have, in times, had the shorter hairstyles, we'll call them, the results are that they become less self-creative, and follow more of a mold that might be have been set for them. And the result is that they, that it's easier for them to be self-creative with a little bit longer hair, provided that they're doing it properly, and they're properly meaning that they're creating themselves and helping others to create themselves in a enlightened way. So that's kind of a strange thing about hair. Is hair actually has some effect on us, and who would believe it? But and then people say, well, what about baldness? You know, like, well, when you lose your hair, or as you lose your hair, you lose some of the subtle ability to be astrally creative. For some people, this may be a benefit if they're already being self-destructive. And I have found that people who are self-destructive tend to lose their hair. If their self-destructiveness is related to their astral nature, it's sort of like a self-protective device. It actually is, it's like the body's way of dealing with reducing the amount of destructiveness. Isn't that fascinating? That kind of fascinating. And the reverse is kind of true, that if you're using the energies in a very positive, very virtuous way, you may keep more of your hair. Also, the color of your hair changes over time. We lose color of hair because that also diminishes the amount of astral creativity. Yeah, gray hair or white hair diminishes some astral creativity, whereas colored hair of various colors increases it in different ways, depending upon what color you choose to use. And no, I'm not going to go through each color right now. There's no time for that to explain all that. But the interesting thing is that this is a remarkable quality that most people don't know about, that even the hair color, and I'm not talking about natural color here. I mean, say, if you color your hair, it's going to affect, to some extent, the amount of astral creativity that you're going to have. It may also slightly affect your etheric body, too. So all of this is an amazing array of, we'll say, how life energy is all about us, and it has remarkable effects on who we are. And we have effects on how it responds. Okay, so let's move on to another part of the subject. If you're going to choose the environment to live in that is going to be most helpful to yourself, I'm talking about like a forest or a city or a town, large, small, etc. What you want to live in is the environment that produces the best balance inside of you, and then the highest amount of development of the two qualities of the chi energy with the pranic energies. The balance is first and foremost more important because an environment that produces an imbalance in a person almost always leads to a state of self-destructiveness and then other destructiveness and sometimes violence, sometimes just depression, a lack of motivation, etc. If you find that that is one of your problems, yes, you should work on it from the inward side first, but sometimes moving to a different environment may be helpful. If you understand the different gray-focused energies of different places. You can pick an environment that may be better for you based upon what centers in your body and the ray correspondence are not working properly. That's a whole other science, which we can't get into tonight, but it could be very helpful to understand it, because then you would know where to live. That would be a better environment to live in. Or you could do it by strictly sense. You can just visit all kinds of different places and say, oh, this is it, I feel more balanced here. Balance is the first thing to determine. Then the ability to enhance and grow in the balance without getting out of balance becomes even more crucial. So the two have to be tested out. You may not be able to determine it without being in a place for several days or weeks at a time. And it could take a long time, therefore, by hit or miss, trying to find the right environment. But that is one way to try and do it. The better way is to figure it out by ray structures and what senses are not working so well. And it's a lot more. You have to have a lot better understanding than what I could have given you tonight about all this. Okay, so environment becomes critical for some people. Other people who are in service, if you're focused out, you can live anywhere, provided that your service is needed the most where you're at. If you go and you do the most amount of services you can from wherever you're at, then that's where you need to be. And even if it throws you off and you lose some balance, it's okay to lose balance if you are in service, because you will regain it at a higher level. For a short time, you may suffer some consequences. But generally speaking, that's an okay thing. That's metaphysically and in some quarters of spiritual development considered a natural process that people actually sometimes go through. So don't think that you always have to be having the ideal place to be, because the ideal place to be is where you can serve others the most. Follow me? I hope so. Okay. So don't get bound up on this. I got to be by the ocean because that's where I really feel the best. Well, but the only people you can serve are the fish. Well, that isn't going to probably do it for you, unless you're at the level in consciousness of being a fish. Maybe you can serve them. But you see, yes, if you're a marine biologist and you're trying to improve the life in the oceans, that's a different thing. But I'm saying, let's assume that that's not your career. And so what you're looking for is, where can I serve the best? And your service is always a calling coming from your soul. That comes from meditation, being in touch with that, with the other two elements of Kundalini, so that you can reach your soul better. And being better in touch with your soul through both meditation, education, which is what we're doing right now, and then in actually serving others. That's the best way to know where and how you should be in any place in your life. It's through the act of serving you will know it. It's amazing. It truly is. It's almost like we have radar. We can determine God in ourselves and know when we're doing the most service we can, because we have a direct feedback device. Now, can I tell you what that exactly is? No, because each person, they have a kind of different sense of it, because each person is creating it. If they're creating it themselves, I can't give you a cookie-cutter explanation of how you would know it. You'll know it when you do it, and that's all I can tell you. You see. Now, if you read a book written from some person who supposedly knows better, be highly skeptical, because they usually are missing the very concept I explained. And no, you can't follow their recipe, because that recipe is away from being creative. It's about being something they are just telling you about, which is not a useful way. All right. So let's move on to, I probably can cover just one more area here. If a person is seeking this, we'll say, ideal sense of life energy in themselves, the best way to achieve that is through being around a group of people who have a common interest in the service that they are seeking to do with and about others. Now, generally, these are more advanced people that are doing this. But if you can, find a group that is doing this or form your own. It's never an excuse to say, well, I don't know any group around me, because you can start your own. And starting your own is just simply putting up maybe a note on Craigslist or some other social thing, network or whatever they call it, and letting people know what you want to do, what you want to be creative about, and allowing them to interact with you to find if you really are pursuing a common service. Then you know you found someone that's a part of a group of people that'll work. You say, well, why can't, if I'm developing it creatively and individually, why can't I serve in a group? Why do I have to serve in a group? Because when you join the two sides of the pranic energies and the kundalini energies, the result is that you join together individuality with group consciousness. You now are benefiting from both rather than exclusively one or the other. And you're amazing. You're getting both the feminine and masculine side, yin and yang, together. And you're dealing with this in such an amazing way now that you can function together with others as though you're one, even though each is creating individually and separately within the one, yet together, collectively, they're able to do far more than any one of them can do alone. And that's the goal. It's the magic of spiritual groups. Spiritual groups are not cults by any stretch of the imagination. A cult is the exact opposite. A cult demands that people be the same as usually one or a few people who run it, and then the rest of the people are the slaves of the ones who run it, and there is virtually no creativity other than the forced regimentation of the mind of someone or a few people who seek power and control over others. That's the opposite of a spiritual group. It's almost the exact opposite of a spiritual group. So you want to be careful never to either create a cult or to become a member of one or join one, because you're moving in the wrong direction from spiritual development. And what happens is the pranic energies and kundalinis, or we'll just say chi, because most people that have raised kundalinis won't become part of a cult, but nonetheless, they become greatly imbalanced in a cult, and you have bizarre behaviors that start taking place. You have self-destructive behaviors. You have other destructive behaviors. You have a very, very negative environment. No matter where the cult may be located, it could be located in the most, well, sublime area. Some of them choose sublime areas to hide or mask the fact that they're very ugly on the interior elements of their quote-unquote group existence. So be very careful of that and realize that a true spiritual group is a group that is focused on serving others, not themselves, and there is no power structure that controls people and forces people to be anything. Everybody is trying to become the most themselves. There could be a leader of the group. The leader is only there to try to help people to understand by their own choice when they are in illusion and having difficulties, not that they have to march to one step with everybody else. That's if it's any kind of regimentation like that, at best, it's only useful maybe in a military operation, and even then, some debate about that. Well, we're running out of time, and there are a few other areas I would have loved to have gotten into it. We didn't really get to about being involved with another person romantically and how these energies interact in those ways, and there's all kinds of stuff we didn't have chance to do. But I've covered some of those elements in other shows, just not from this angle. And maybe some other time we'll have a chance to visit about this subject again. But for right now, I hope that you do understand what life energy is all about. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.